Started. So today we're going to talk about sensory motor systems. So today is the first of two lectures on physiology before we have the midterm. So the reason we're looking at sensory motor systems is that this is the interface to the other stuff that we're talking about. So it's the interface between the human and the human body and the human mind to the outside world. Sensory systems allow us to figure out what's going on in the world, and then motor systems allow us to control it. So if you think about it, this is kind of our doorway to the world, right? So as individuals. So these are very important, and we're going to spend most of our time on sensory because it's kind of a long lecture. At the end, we'll talk about motor systems as well. Okay, so let's get started. So the first thing we should know is just some general concepts about how sensory systems work. So first you have the stimulus come in, and the stimulus is anything in the outside world that causes us to kind of notice it. And then usually what happens is that there's a sensory receptor. It could be anything. It could be cells in your eyes, for example. It could be cells in your skin that senses touch. And that will actually go on to another cell in the system, and other cells will actually go to the nervous system. Okay, we talk about nervous system next time, but this time we're just going to mention it. So what happens is that you have the stimulus come in, and when the stimulus comes in, that causes this cell to basically fire. Okay, so don't worry about this stuff yet. We'll talk about that next time. But when it's firing, then it's going to tell the next cell, which now goes to the nervous system, that something has happened. So the idea is that you want to communicate this information, however you get it, if it's touch, if it's hearing, if it's vision, and communicate that downstream to the nervous system so that the nervous system knows. So next time we'll talk about nervous systems. And so in this case, though, in the case of the sensory receptor, what happens is that different types of stimulation will give you different signals that tells the brain different things. So in this example, it's a sensory receptor of a skin. So what happens is that when you just give a little bit of pressure, you have low frequency of firing. So the cell is just going like duh, 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 duh. Firing like that, and then when you give it more pressure, the cell is going to go bruh, 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 like that. Okay, so the brain is going to now interpret this as, oh, like I was touched hard, as opposed to I was touched lightly. Okay, so it's all up to how the nervous system interprets it, and I will talk about the nervous system next time. Now, what you notice is that we were very general in stating that the sensory receptor could be sort of sensing anything in our world. So in particular, you can sense touch, you can sense visual cues, so that means picking up on specific wavelengths of light in the world. You can also sense taste, so the chemical sense. Smell is also a chemical sense, except it's an airborne thing. And then also hearing. Okay, so these are kind of the canonical five senses. Okay. There are actually other receptors in addition to this. You don't need to, these are just examples for me to tell you, but in addition to the stuff that we talk about, there's also some really interesting things like chemoreceptors, for example. That's actually sensing your own body's levels of certain chemicals, for example, oxygen, glucose, so that, you know, like, so if you have low glucose level in your blood, for example, that stimulates you to eat more, for example, right? There's some interesting stuff in different animals as well, electromagnetic receptors, right? So in some flies and things like that. And then a couple of interesting things also is that thermal receptor senses temperature, so you can actually sense temperature in the world. So skin receptors sort of sense temperature, but they're kind of deeper in the skin. But there are actually receptors that sense just the temperature as well. And it turns out they're actually related to, you know, like, so when you eat spicy food, For example, that actually stimulates the thermal receptors in addition to the taste. So there's some interesting properties there. Nociceptors are specific for pain. That's also important because when you get a pain, that's telling you something, that the body is wrong. Something is wrong in the body. Okay. There are also things that sense gravity and equilibrium. Okay, so these are the things that go wrong when you have motion sickness, for example. Again, this is just detail that you don't have to know. But, for example, in the invertebrates, you have these structures that basically, if you think about, what do you call those clocks that when you turn it and the sand goes down? Yeah, I can't remember how to say that in English. But that kind of thing where you have, like, for example, sand in a bottle or something like that, right? This is kind of what's happening, okay? So you have a lot of cells that are surrounding this chamber. And then inside you have these things called statolites. And that's just the sand that I'm talking about. And when you're moving around in the world, what happens to that sand? It's going to move around, right? When it moves around, it's going to stimulate different fibers, right? The different, in this case, cilia of these cells. So what that means is just that different cells are going to be activated. That's all. So if you're stable and you're standing up, then you're always going to be firing these cells right here, right? But when you're moving around in the world, you're shaking around in a boat, right? Or in an earthquake, then you're going to be activating some really interesting cells that's going to tell the body something is wrong. It's like, what's going on, right? So that's really what happens when you're able... this is what allows you to sense the gravity in the world and to notice that something is wrong if you're not in an equilibrium. Okay. So anyway, so that's just an aside. So today's main topics, one, we have hearing, okay? That's important because that is the thing that allows you to listen to this lecture, right? So the reason hearing and vision are different. So the second thing is vision, okay? And the third thing is kind of like everything else, and then motor system. So there's four-part lecture. But now getting back to hearing, the thing about the difference between hearing and vision is that vision is a very precise thing that allows you to say specifically there's this in the world. But hearing is different. Hearing, you don't get the quite very specific location specificity, although you could kind of tell a little bit based on the two ears, how the sound information is coming into the two ears. But the thing that you're getting with hearing is that you're able to get some sensitivity, right? If things are, like, if you notice yourself, well, tonight you can try, right? Before you go to sleep, just, instead of just sleeping, right before you go to sleep, just tune out and just listen. Like, actually, we just listen right now. Very light, you can hear very slight things going on. Like, so when you're falling asleep, maybe you can hear the, I don't know where you guys live, but, you know, like bugs outside, that kind of thing. Or if you're near a street or something, you can hear, little sirens, police sirens. Okay, that's where I live, okay. But, you can hear some really small thing if you actually tune into it, okay? And the other thing about hearing is that's different from vision in some sense is that it's very, very selective, right? So right now you guys are all paying attention to me more or less. Most of you are paying attention to me, okay? When there's something interesting, something cool going on, you're hearing, boom, it's just like you can... Like, for example, right? They did an experiment... This is totally aside, but they did an experiment where... they're asked to listen to, recipe to make cement. Okay, the most boring thing ever. Just imagine the most boring thing ever. First you put in the whatever mix into the whatever concrete and the concrete, blah, 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 blah. You're listening. So in the middle of that, they say the name of whoever is participating in one case, or they say the name of some absolutely non... important individual, Bob, okay, or Ingrid, right? Now, like, they, so what happens in the seizure is that they just tune out, they kind of not paying attention, because afterwards you can give a test and you go like, okay, so how many grams of whatever did you put into whatever? And they go like, I don't know, I wasn't paying attention. But when they hear the name, boom, it's like, whoa, it's like, forget about cement. Like, what's going on? You want me to do something? So it's like a very salient thing. So hearing is like that. It's very selective. But regardless of what's going on, like, for example, your name is like, as soon as I say somebody's name, boom, they pay attention, right? It doesn't matter even if they're tuned out. Even sometimes when they're like kind of drowsy and sleeping, you say somebody's name and they go like, oh, what's going on? So hearing is kind of like that. It's very selective. Okay? Whereas the post-vision is kind of everything is going on. It's also selective, but it's not, you know, hearing is a little bit more, even more selective than that. So anyway, so that's hearing. We're going to go into some detail, but again, you don't have to know every single thing in here. I will just kind of go over in general. So first, the physiology, so kind of like the mechanism for how hearing is happening, okay? So first you have sound coming in, so this is the outer ear, and then it goes into this auditory canal. So again, I forgot to mention this, but sound are just kind of pressure waves, okay? So it's unlike vision, which is kind of electromagnetic, you're sensing electromagnetic wavelengths, so very precise kind of things. But sound is more, how do you say, it's a more global thing where it's actually pressure, it's actually vibrating things, okay? So that's the thing that's, and how you modify that sound allows you to kind of get a different perception of that sound. So the pressure waves actually come in through this auditory canal, and it's what happens is that because it's just changes in pressure in the air, really, okay? Because of that, what you need is a mechanism for sensing pressure. So that's what this tympanic membrane is, okay? So the tympanic membrane is basically something that's in your ear that's sensing this pressure vibration. Now, what you want to do, though, is that, you know, everything has sound pressure in it, right? Everything has... Basically, everything that's going on in the world, you know, rare factions of air, okay? So the question is, how do you actually pick up on these very detailed information that's out there? You know, like, for example, most of the sound we hear are just kind of nonsense things. People walking, right? Like, yelling, things like that. But how is it that you're getting this information from language where... When I say something, when you say something, it's a very specific, you know, change in the structure of that sound. Like, how do you pick up that very fine difference? You know, things that allow you to pick up, first of all, the difference between, say, Chinese and Korean, right? And then not only that, but how do you pick up the difference between people who even have accents, right? You can figure those things out. How do you pick up those very fine differences? So what that means is that you have to be very fine-tuned to these very big changes in the pressure. So what that means is that you need to amplify the sound signal. Okay, so that's the kind of the message here, is that this tympanic membrane will vibrate to sound. But what you need to do is you need to amplify that, and you need to be selective in the sense that when it's higher frequency noise versus lower frequency noise, you have to be able to differentiate. Okay? So first, the amplification, you have basically a bunch of bones here. One of them actually looks like this stirrup, you know, like the horse stirrup. And then, so basically, it just goes, you know, the sound vibrates this membrane, and then the membrane kind of transduces the sound to these bones. And the bone basically now is going to kind of transduce this sound into an internal organ, which allows you to differentiate and interpret the sound. So again, it kind of amplifies the signal so that even in a small structure, now you have this big changes in the membrane fluctuation into a small and very specific change in the input to the hearing organ. Okay. Now, the hearing organ is basically most of what we're going to be concerned with in terms of hearing today, okay? So it's called the cochlea, okay? So that you do need to know. So the cochlea, it looks like this snail kind of thing, right? So what happens is that there's something on the side here that you don't, I mean, I guess you should know, but on the side here, there's also these things called semicircular canals, and that is actually the thing that allows you to sense the gravity. Is the analog of what we talked about earlier with statoliths and stuff like that. But that's not what we're talking about right now. But anyway, so that's on the side here. It's the thing that allows you to sense the gravity. But the cochlea is the thing that interprets the sound. Basically, the sound comes in through the stapes, and then you have a sound that goes through into this cochlea, and then the pressure comes back out. Through the round window. So you don't have to know the name of these windows, but basically there's one window that goes into the cochlea, one window that comes out, basically. And the one that goes in has a bone attached to it, so that's going like that, right? And then we'll talk about how the cochlea works, but the idea is that this is the amplification stage, okay? You have the tympanic membrane. The bones allows you to get much finer control. And then in the cochlea, it's going to interpret this sound as one pitch versus another. Okay, and you notice that, well, for most of us who are, you know, interested in music, for example, you can actually tell the difference between this tone, and this tone, right? Some people can tell between like very small differences in the pitch. And that is actually what's going on in the cochlea. Okay. So here's, first of all, so this is what the cochlea looks like, right? So what the next picture is, it's going to be rolling out the cochlea. So the cochlea is rolled like this, right? So now we're going to lay it flat like a piece of bread, okay? Lay it out, lay it back down. And when you do that, and you cut a slice through, so that slice is like this slice right here. If you see this picture, hope you guys can see. Yeah, right here, that's a slice through the cochlea. When you look at that slice, this is what it looks like. Okay, you have basically different canals. Okay, so it turns out it kind of goes through the tympanic canal and comes back out of the vestibular canal, but you don't have to worry about that. Basically, throughout these canals, you have pressure waves going in, right? So these pressure waves come in and they cause vibration in this cochlea, right? So there is something called, and you should know this, but there's something called organ of Corti, which sits inside the cochlea, okay? So the organ of Corti is the thing that now interprets these pressure waves, okay? So it turns out the organ of Corti has a very, it's also involved a little bit in the amplification stage, but the organ of Corti actually has things, these things called hair cells. So these are actually the same cells, I didn't mention it specifically, but it's the same cells as the ones in these equilibrium sensing cells. You know, they have these cilia, so they're called hair cells. I forgot to mention this. But these are actually the same types of cells, but they just do slightly different things here. So in this case, they sit in the organ of Corti, and they interpret these pressure waves. So I'll tell you how that is actually done. Okay. So now this is inside the organ of Corti. So remember, the pressure wave is now gonna come in and vibrate these tectorial membranes. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, not the tectorial. It's gonna vibrate the vascular membrane. Okay. So it's kind of the tectorial membrane is more or less just sitting there, and it's gonna vibrate these vascular membrane. Okay, so this is now sitting on the floor here, inside here. The pressure wave is going to come in particular, the ones that are coming through the tympanic membrane now basically vibrates the bottom of this, right? Okay, so when you vibrate the bottom of this, it's going to vibrate the vascular membrane. The textural membrane is kind of sitting there. And then what you notice now is that the hair cells are on this thing called the vascular membrane, which again sits on the floor of this organ of Corti. And then what happens is that the little cells are actually attached. They're kind of not attached, but they're kind of brushing against the textorial membrane on the top. Okay? And these cells all have an output stage. So the output of these cells are they're these long structures called axons, and that, you know, right now all you have to know is that these guys are transmitting information further down into the nervous system. Okay? But these cells are very intricate. It has the hair things that are kind of sitting right there, and whenever pressure comes in, it fluctuates that, right? It moves that cell so that the hairs move, and then when the hairs move, as I'll tell you next, it's going to change how these cells are firing. Okay? So this is the key, right? You going from the pressurized pressure in the system to a neural signal that now you can interpret. So remember, when we go all the way back to this, this is what we want, right? We want differences in the stimulus to cause us to have different firing, basically. So that allows the nervous system to figure out what this is. And this is, for hearing, this is where it's happening. Okay, so this is the key. Okay, now how does that hairstyle actually work? Like, how do you actually, you know, move from these small deflections to actual neural signals? Okay, so this is what the hair cells look like. If you actually look at the electron microscope, what it looks like little piles of teeth. Okay, and again, they are sitting right on top of the vascular membrane, and the vascular membrane is going to move, and then as it moves, it's going to move the hair cells, which are brushing against the textorial membrane. Okay. Okay, this is the interesting stuff. So this is how it works. So how do you get the vibrations in that vascular membrane to cause the hair cells to actually fire differently? Okay, so this is what happens. So when the hair is not being bent, okay, so which means it's kind of like just sitting on the textorial membrane, but it's not, there's no pressure to move it, I guess, right? When that happens, actually, the hair cell, okay, it's always going to be giving off transmitters, which is basically the signal that it communicates to the next cell in the chain. It's always going to give those neurotransmitters to the next cell, which is the sensory neuron, and that sensory neuron is just always going to be firing. Okay, so this hair cell is sitting always at the same voltage, right? So cells are always, you know, they're sitting at some voltage, okay? The way to think about this is that everything in our system, the cell, is always going to have a certain number of proteins versus other chemicals. And when you put all that together, it's going to sit at some negative, you know, voltage, basically. Okay? Hope that's, that's just the way cells work. They kind of they sit at some voltage, and then when you change that voltage, it's allowing the cells to do different things like firing. Okay. Well, in this case, it's always going to be releasing these transmitters, and then that next cell is always going to be firing because it's getting these transmitters. Okay. All right. So now, when you have the deflection of the cell, right? When you have deflection of those hairs, now what that's going on is that the inside that cell, when you have the hair deflections, it's going to cause certain changes in the chemical properties of the cell. So how does that happen? It opens certain channels, right? So for example, if you open chloride channels, chloride is going to come in, makes the cell more negative. For example, if you open sodium channels, sodium is going to come in, makes the cell more positive. Okay, so when it's resting, it's just sitting at minus 70, and that's because some of the proteins are negative, and et cetera, et cetera. So the cell's always resting at the minus 70 or so. But when you have the deflection of the cell, that causes certain channels to open. Also some transporters also open. And that causes the membrane potential to fluctuate. So in this case, it's showing you that when the hair is brushed one way, this membrane potential is getting more positive. So certain channels open, sodium channels open, for example, allows you to be more positive. And then when the hair cells brush the other way, other channels open, or perhaps the sodium channels close, and then that allows you to be more negative. But however you want to do it, basically the idea is that you're getting membrane fluctuation. Okay, so the membrane of the membrane potential of the cell, the voltage at which the cell is sitting, is now going to change. But when it changes, what that means is that the chemicals that it releases downstream, right, is also going to change. So in this case, it's going to release more chemical because the cell is more positive. Okay, so there's like more calcium, etc., and then it releases more chemicals, as opposed to when it becomes more negative, when it's releasing less. Now, the next cell in the chain, the cell that actually is going to go to the nervous system, is now going to either fire more or fire less in response to these fluctuations. But guess what? This is what exactly you want. You have a system now that does exactly this, right? And this is what you want to do because you wanted to transmit, you know, pressure information, in this case in the form of deflection of the hair cell, into actual neural signals. So the brain now can interpret this as sound, okay? Vibrating in one way and the other. When you put things together in time, the brain is going to allow you to understand that this is actually a particular type of sound information. Okay, so again, the important thing is that you have a mechanical change, you have a mechanical distortion of these cilia in the hair cells, and that allows you to have channels that either open or close in the hair cell, which now transmit that information downstream to the next cell, which tells the nervous system that actually it was firing a lot or firing less. What that is interpreted is as sound in the brain. Okay? Any questions so far about hearing and hair cell? Okay. There's some detail here, but the main logic of the system is pretty clear. Okay, so now that is the thing that actually tells you the nervous system that there's sound going on. But again, let's go back to the idea that how are we getting the different pitches? So how do we differentiate the different types of sound? Not only the pitch, but also slightly the texture, right? So let's go back to the cochlea. So this is the cochlea, okay? And when you unroll the cochlea, it just kind of looks like this, right? So it's a little bit wider on the input end, and then, well, it's both the input and the output end, but it's a little bit wider on the outer part, and then a little bit narrower in the inner part, okay? And the basilar membrane actually gets a little bit bigger as you go through. I don't think you necessarily have to know every single detail here, but it is really cool, so I'll just tell you about it. Okay, so what we said earlier about the hair cell deflecting, that's going to be picking up on the amplitude of sound. If you have a bigger deflection of the hair cell, that's going to give you bigger, you know, larger firing, right? And if you have more firing or more changes in big and small, that just tells you the sound has high amplitude. It's really loud. Okay, so that's depending on how the hair cell is going to deflect. Okay, the bigger deflection means that you have greater sound pressure, and that means it's a louder sound. Okay, but now this next part is talking about pitch, which is this different frequency of sound, different quality of sound, right? If I talk really low like that, that's going to be a different pitch. If I talk really high like this, that's a different pitch. Okay? So In this case, you actually need a physical mechanism in the cochlea that allows you to pick up the different frequencies of sound. And the way that the human does this, and also it's very similar, by the way, in many different animals as well, so it's kind of a universally evolved structure, and that is the following. So basically the cochlea has a property where the vibration of the sound actually maximally deflects the basal membrane at different frequencies in the cochlea. Okay, so get your mind around that information, right? Every time you're hearing something, it's actually kind of maximally deflecting a different part of the cochlea. So this is really cool. So basically what happens is that, for example, so if you have low-frequency sound, right? So low tone like this, right? What happens is that it's going to maximally deflect kind of this inner region. Why is that? Well, because this is the region that's kind of the thinnest out, and the basal membrane is widest. So if the membrane is widest, it's picking up even the low pitch, right? Low frequency information, right? Low frequency means it's going to change very slowly over time, right? Very, very fine tuned, right? And again, if you have high pitch information, then it's going to maximally deflect the outer part of the cochlea. And again, it's just the way that this thing is constructed. The basal membrane is thinner, so it's vibrating more easily to higher pitch. Okay. Again, sound is going to come through the oval window and exit the outer window, so it's actually traversing through this entire structure. So what I mean is the sound is going to come through right here, and it's going to go all the way into the apex and then come all the way back out. Okay. But either way you do it, the key thing is that it's actually maximally deflecting different parts of the cochlea at different wavelengths of sound. So different pitch of sound, right? Different pitch of sound is actually deflecting maximally different part of the cochlea. Okay, so this is what is shown on this plot here. High frequency sound, so that's really high pitch, you're deflecting mostly here. Low frequency sound, you're deflecting more in here. Okay, but that is actually allowing to pick up the pitch information, right? So together with the amplitude, which is how well you're deflecting the hair cell, and the location of deflection within the cochlea, now you have most of what you need to interpret sound information. Okay? So, again, this is what I already said, but I'll just say it again. So the pressure wave is going to come through the tympanic membrane. The bones are going to transduce that into the cochlea. And when it's in the cochlea, it goes through within inside the cochlea. So this is, again, rolled out, and then coming back over. And throughout this process, it's actually vibrating within the cochlea, right? So it's actually vibrating the basilar membrane. The basilar membrane has hair cells on it, and these cells are actually touching the tympanic membrane. And when you give a different pitch of sound, it's actually maximally deflecting the hair cells that are different distance from the entrance, right? So that's what's shown on the right. If you are farther away from the oval window, you're maximally picking up the low frequency sound, 100 hertz. When you're closer to the oval window, which means it's earlier in the cochlea here, A, then it's more responsive to the high frequency tone. So you notice that it's an absolute thing, right? It's still different parts of the cochlea is still picking up all kinds of pitch. It's not like, oh, it's only going to pick up 1,000 hertz and that's all it does. That's not how it works. It's all a curve. It's all probability. It's picking up more of the high frequency as opposed to the lower frequency. Yeah. But when you collect all these hair cells together and you put all that information together, then you get a very fine-tuned signal, right? So I guess the thing to know here is that even in this structure, there's still a lot of chaos, there's a lot of still randomness that comes out of these signals, right? So remember, these hair cells are going to cause all kinds of firing. Some of these cells are going to go, right? Some of these cells are going to be, and then somehow, the brain interprets all this into beautiful music. All right. So how does it actually do that? It's a very fine-tuned system. This is only the sensory component. This is just giving you the groundwork for how the brain can actually ultimately do it. Okay. All right. So as I said before, hearing is similar in some sense to equilibrium and gravity sensing. So in this case, again, what I said before, the semicircular canals are the ones that are picking up on the sense of hearing. And again, these are also hair cells, but in terms of humans, they actually have these things called cupulas, which again, basically is also sensing the gravity, because when you move, they actually move a certain direction, and that causes, and the same idea, it causes the hair cells to be deflected in different ways, and that allows the brain to interpret that as being in different situations in regards to gravity. Okay, so let's give a quick review. I'm definitely on time this time, so and also take roll. So why don't you take a look at these questions, and then I will also try to... You guys can still see this, right? I'm going to try to... sort of do this. Here, I'll show you... that. You can kind of more or less see that, okay? Think about these questions as I'm taking a roll. So, Yuichiro, not here. That's probably Yushen, he's here. Leia, Jennifer, and Jennifer. Cole, here. Sakura. Ingrid, Akari, Akemi, June, Makoto, Ayurim, Sayaka, Ben, Nune, Yuri, probably not here, but Aoi, not here. Shinji, not here. Susanna, not here yet. Okay. Minho, yes. Okay. Alexander, okay. And then Ying Jun. Okay, so hopefully these should be fairly easy. Is that the case? You guys already know. Anybody have an answer for number one, the one on the left? Which sensory cells are common to both hearing and equilibrium? Anybody? What did I talk about most? You can just yell it out. You don't have to raise your hand. Huh? That's right. Hair cells. Great. Nice. Good. Yeah, it's kind of what we were talking about, right? Okay. And then the next one. What is the function of the basal membrane? I talked about this as well, but see if you can go in and eliminate wrong information, right? That's probably the easiest. Which ones do you know are not right, right off the bat? Anybody want to try? Anybody want to guess? Okay, good try, good try. But tell me how you came to that. What are you thinking? Good try. So you came in slightly late. So maybe that's okay. So remember the tympanic membrane to oval. That's a good question though. Let's go over it, right? So going from the tympanic membrane to the oval window. Let me go over that again, okay? So that is this part. The tympanic membrane to the oval window. So what is the thing that's transducing that sound? These bones, right? So the bone is actually the one that amplifies the sound going from the tympanic membrane to the to this first window here. Okay, so that's what A is talking about. Now, is that where the basal membrane sit? It's not, right? But anyways, but that's good. Now you can eliminate. So this is a good idea. So you go, is it A? I don't think it's A because of the following. Now what else? What else can you eliminate on the exam, which is happening in 2 weeks? What else can we eliminate? Anybody else can eliminate one more? Good. Why is that? Exactly. Exactly. Great. That's exactly what you want. So just like Ingrid was saying, vibrating in response to the air on the outside, that's what the job of the tympanic membrane is. So therefore, it's not that because we're talking about basal membrane, right? You can also eliminate D because it doesn't create pressure waves, right? Like, it's not the thing that's creating the wave. It's the sound that's coming in and causing it to vibrate. Then you go like, okay, wait, can these all be wrong? Right? And then you say, well, does it vibrate up and down in response to the fluid pressure? Yeah, it does, right? It does vibrate. You know. So, therefore, that's the answer, hair cells. And then, again, if you don't know what the answer is, you go and look through each one and you try to figure out whether it could be eliminated. And most of the time, actually, on the test, right, it's going to point to something else. For example, the A, that's talking about the bones. It's going to be something like that, or C, where it's talking about the tympanic membrane. It's going to be talking about something else, which now you can eliminate because now the question is asking for some other thing. Okay. So anyway, so that's hearing. We're good on time. So now we're going to move on to vision. So unlike hearing, which is picking up on these kind of very global massive deflections in air, vision is a little bit more of a precise in the sense that it's actually picking up very, very specific information in the world, in the electromagnetic radiation of the world, okay? Okay, so what do these things look like? So, so first of all, in non-humans, let me just talk about insects real fast, right? So in insects, actually, they actually have these things called compound eyes, right? So compound eyes just means that instead of having a single eye, it's going to have a bunch of different little small pieces of eye, right? These are all eyes, actually. They have their own lens and et cetera, and they have their own photoreceptor, which is basically is the actual thing that's picking up on the wavelength of light. The actual photons that it's actually picking up. So this is the sensory receptor for vision. But insects actually have a bunch of those arranged all around. So if you notice in this fly, right, it actually has eyes in many, many directions, right? So what that means actually is that because of this, it's very, very sensitive. It's able to pick up on all kinds of angles, right? This is why it's very difficult to swat a fly. It's as soon as you sneak up on them, boom, they know, because they have like more than this 360. Like when we're looking, we have this big fish eye circular view, more or less, of the world. Well, now imagine having that everywhere, right? Like in this kind of oval shape. A lot more information. It turns out the properties are different. So each eye is not going to give you as much information, but it turns out it's much better suited for pick up information like motion. Right? It's very, very broad look. Okay. So that's what insects have. Now the human eye, this is a scary picture, I know. Try not to stare at it, right? After a while you get dazed. Okay, so the human eye actually, we only have two eyes, right? And it turns out the two eye actually allows us to tell the difference in distance between things, because the information that's going through one eye and the other eye is actually different, okay? But the idea is that you're going to now have all this information that's coming in into just these two organs, right? So the way it focuses also is changing the lens of this eye. So when it changes the shape of these outer areas of the eye, the light is going to bend and also going to go through and focus on different parts of the retina. Okay, so the retina is the main kind of layer of cells at the back of the eye that's actually picking up on the photon. Okay, all right. So the pupil is this outer area. So the pupil is where the light is actually going to enter, right? So when you have an eye exam, for example, what people do is they actually put this little, you know, puff that allows you to dilate the pupil. Dilating just means making the pupil bigger. And that basically what happens is that it does stuff to this muscle so that the muscle kind of opens up more so that you're getting more light going in. Right? So the pupil can actually dilate or shrink in response to this. And the light is going to enter through just this sort of round pupil black area. Okay. Other stuff to know, the cornea, that's the outer surface here. It's not as important. The iris is the thing that controls the pupil size, basically. And then you have a lens that's right after that. So the light comes in, but it's bent differently by the lens. Again, when you focus on something in the back versus something in front, if you try to do this right now, right, you focus on me, say, my forehead, right? And then you try to focus something very close, like on your desk, you notice that it's a very different view of the world. So, for example, if everybody focuses on the desk, right? You put your focus on the desk, and then you kind of, on the corner of your eye, try to see. So while focusing on the desk, try to see, sort of be aware of what you're seeing outside. You notice stuff is blurred, right? You guys notice that? So when you're focusing very close, then the stuff on the surrounding is blurry, right? You can't really tell. And that's where the lens is coming in. The lens is bent in such a way that the maximal light that's coming in focus, in the back of your eye, is this particular distance in the desk that I was saying. And everything else, the light is going to come in and does not have a single point in the retina where the light is all focused on. So therefore, it's just blurry. It's being blurred. All right. As opposed to when you're focusing far away, like my forehead or the slides, then you're focusing on something far, and the stuff that's close now is no longer in focus. Okay. And so when you bend this lens, it's going to go. The light is going to come in such a way that it's going to different light from different distances is going to be in a single point in the retina in a different place depending on this lens.
Yes, I guess I should have had a picture of that, but
anyways, there are actually some diseases that are involved. For example, just because we're in sales and we like to talk about diseases, there's this thing called glaucoma. So glaucoma just means that you can't, if there's a failure to drain this liquid that's inside this eye here. So it's actually called this aqueous humor, but anyways, it's just a, it's just something that's within the eye. And so what that means is it builds up this extra material, and now it gets really cloudy because it basically blocks this kind of entry point into the eye. Okay. So anyway, so this is how the eye works. So the key thing here, though, to notice is that, first of all, there's a center part of this retina, right? So the retina, like, remember, it's this layer of cells in the eye that's actually picking up on the photons, the light, right? But there's actually a central part of that, right? And in addition, there's also a place where the axons, the output information needs to go to the brain, right? So all these cells in the retina communicating with each other, ultimately you're going to have something that goes out, right? And also blood vessels and stuff like that. So there is actually a point where there is no photoreceptors. So there is a point in here where you cannot see, and it's called the blind spot. Okay? Now, why is it that when I'm just looking like this, I don't see a blind spot, right? There should be something in the world at all configurations where I should not be able to tell what is actually there. Okay, it's not in the center because it's not the fovea, that's fine, because that's not, it's not where I'm focused on. Somewhere off to the side. Why am I not seeing a blind spot? So it turns out the answer is that the brain is so smart, it automatically fills in that information. Okay. So in other words, there's a blind spot always in the world somewhere where you don't really see it. Again, because first of all, it's not in focus, right? But it's not, it's being filled in. That information, for example, if there was a desk here, we assume that the desk was gonna just keep going a little bit, you know. There was nothing in it that tells me that that's there, but it's filled in by the nervous system. Somehow the brain can interpret that information. Okay. So there is a blind spot. Okay, everybody has blind spots. Okay. Now, how do you actually have the sensory receptors to vision work? So it has basically two main types of sensory receptors, right? One are called rods and one are called cones. This is important, so this is something you should know. So rods are the ones that have low acuity, so it means it doesn't have quite the specific spatial information, but has very high sensitivity. So for example, when all the lights are off, then you're using your rods because it's very sensitive, right? It's picking up on even small levels of light. And it turns out it's actually located on the kind of peripheral part of the retina more. Okay, so I'll show you a graph of that in a second. Let me see if I have it. I don't have it right now. But it turns out it's kind of located on the side of the retina more. But rods are only picking up on light versus no light. So what that means is it's black and white. If you're watching a movie, then if you're interpreting the world based on rods only, you're looking at a black and white movie, right? So cones, though, are different. Cones, they have three different types, right? And the three different types are just red, green, and blue, right? So that is allowing you to have color information. So it's picking on different specific wavelengths of light. It has very high acuity because if you notice the tip of this cone, right, it's very small as opposed to rod, which is a bigger tip. So this is the point in the retina, basically. So what that means is that the light is going to, in order to activate this cone, it has to specifically activate this part, as opposed to rod, which can activate any of these parts. Okay. So what that means is that cone now gives you better spatial acuity, right? Because that spot of light, only the spot that comes from that specific point is going to activate this specific cone, right? But what that means is also it has to have lower sensitivity, because if only that spot of light is going to activate this cone, then stuff that's a little bit nearby, the other photons are slightly nearby, a little bit off to the side of the world that you're looking at, it's not going to activate this cone. Whereas it will activate this rod, because the rod has lower spatial acuity. And basically, so it's a trade-off. If you have higher acuity, you have lower sensitivity. Sensitivity meaning ability to pick up on light, right? And in the case of cone, you have lower sensitivity because you have very specific spatial acuity, right? And it turns out cones are located more in the center, okay? So in the fovea, which is the center part of the retina. So what that also means, though, is that in the dark at night, when the lights are turned on, you're relying more on your rods. And then in the daytime, when you're just walking around, you're relying more on the cones, right? Right. So in the dark, you're actually not going to be able to tell the colors as well. And guess what? That's what happens, right? In the dark, you can't see colors as well, right? Because the cones are not activating in the same way, but the rods are still active. What that also means is that if you can't see something, right? So somebody says, look at that lighthouse way to, like, it's really far away. You can barely see it. Very small number of photons. What that means is that if you want to see that, you look sideways a little bit, right? You focus slightly off of the lighthouse, and then that lighthouse is going to activate some cone that has higher sensitivity, and then you're going to be able to, quote-unquote, see the lighthouse, right? Because you want to use your, kind of the side of your retina where there's a lot of rods, to be able to detect light that's very faint. Okay, so these are the two different types of photoreceptors. I don't have time to go over very specific details on how they work, but let me just tell you basically that inside these photoreceptors, there are these things called rhodopsin. And rhodopsin is just basically a chemical that changes in response to light. So the rhodopsin actually is made of retinal and opsin. So basically, the part that actually changes is called retinal. So that's, you know, actually in carrots and, you know, vitamin A and stuff like that. So this is why people tell you to eat specific types of food when to get better vision. So the retinal actually has, if you remember the very, very first lecture of this class when we talked about cis-trans isomers, it's not so important right now, but basically the retinal has two configurations. One is in the cis form, one is in the trans form, and the light actually causes it to go from one form to the other. That's all it is. So they basically have different isomers. And then the light is going to cause it to change one or the other, and it's actually picking up on this very small change, right? The light causes this very small change in this very specific chemical in the back of the eye, and that chemical, which is part of rhodopsin, is actually the thing that's actually going to eventually tell the rods and cones whether you have some specific light coming in, wavelength of light. So much more kind of precisely tuned and kind of complex structure as opposed to the hearing hair cells. Hair cells are just vibrating. It's very simple in that sense. Okay. Again, you don't have to know all this information. I'll tell you what you should know. So what happens is that when the light comes in, right, it activates this rhodopsin. This is what I said before with the retinal. And then basically it goes through these steps, and then eventually these steps goes to the process in which a chemical gets detached from this ion channel, and the ion channel is now going to basically close. When it closes, then it does not allow sodium to come in. So this is similar in some sense to the hair cell, but I will kind of explain just a little bit of detail. So in the photoreceptors, and so let's say the rod, for example, right? The rod is going to sit at some potential. In this case, it's usually sitting at minus 40, which you notice is a little bit more positive than what we were talking about before. Now, when the light strikes, right? So as opposed to this minus 40, when the light strikes, it does things, and all this transduction of this information, and eventually it closes this sodium channel. If you close the sodium channel, less positive charges come in. What that means is the cell is going to become more negative because less positive coming in. So usually positive comes in and you're sitting at minus 40. Now the positive does not come in, so that means you're going to be more negative. Right? So the precise mechanism is not important, but basically just remember that you have a closure of the sodium channel. Right? So the sodium channel is changed when... Right. I mean, the configuration of the sodium channel is changed in such a way that it does not allow sodium to come in when the light strikes, which means you have a, it's called a hyperpolarization, but that's just a fancy term for saying that the cell is now going to sit more negatively. Okay. Usually, the cell is going to fire when it's more positive, but in this case, it's actually giving you the information for when the cell becomes more negative. When the cell becomes more negative, the brain can now interpret that as light having struck, right? Because usually the sodium is always flowing in. Okay. So it's kind of opposite of how cells usually fire. Okay. But anyway, so that's how it works. So in this, the sodium stops coming in. What that means is that the brain can now interpret that as light. It turns out also that when you have a lot of light, right? So you have a lot of light coming in, it's gonna allow it to make the cell really, really negative, right? And it turns out that if you want to, if you're at that level, when you go back to the regular light, it takes some time to actually adapt because all these sodium channels, they take time to go back to their normal levels. Okay, so that's why when you're going from the outside to the inside, for example, it takes some time for the visual system to actually get back to what is normal. When you're outside in the beach, boom, all of a sudden there's too much light coming in, that sodium channel changes are not going to be picked up immediately. You give it 5-10 seconds, then everything kind of equilibrates, then you're actually picking up on the right level of light. Okay. It turns out there's actually more than just rods and cones, okay, in the system. So the rods and cones are going to look like this. Again, they're sitting in the back of the retina, remember, which is right here in the back of the retina here. Okay. The light comes in, right? So this is the front. So this is the iris is over here, and the pupil is over here. The light's going to come in and strike the back of the retina, but that information actually propagates slightly backwards on the inside of the retina. So it turns out the rods and cones are actually connected to different cell types, right? So horizontal and bipolar cells, not specifically important what they're called, but basically what you have to know is that they're connected to different cell types, and eventually the cell is going to connect it to this thing called a ganglion cell. That is important, okay? So the ganglion cell is the output to the visual system because the fibers of these ganglion cells, the axons of these ganglion cells actually makes up this optic nerve, and the optic nerve is what this thing is, which is exiting through the blind spot to the visual cortex, to the visual system of the brain. Okay, so the ganglion cell is the ultimate output, and the input are the rods and cones, and then you have a layer of cells in between. Okay, so let me just tell you again briefly what I said last time, which is rods again are adapted for the dark because they're more sensitive. And you have these sodium channels both within Okay, so sorry. This slide actually, I'm talking about light versus dark as opposed to rod versus cone. Sorry, let me just... This is an example, so this is a rod. Okay, so a rod in the dark, what's happening? While the rhodopsin is not really active, so the sodium channels are open, so it's kind of giving you neurochemicals all the time. And then the next cell is either going to be firing or not firing based on how it interprets this information. Okay, now the light comes in, and that's going to activate the rhodopsin. What that means is the sodium channel is now going to close. When it closes, the rod is actually going to sit more negative in voltage. When it's more negative, it doesn't release as many chemicals, right? The neurotransmitters are going to be released more when it's more positive. So what that means is that the next cell now can interpret that as light. Okay. All right. So why is it, so just an aside, why is it that you need this layer, right? Can't you just go directly? So in the hearing, remember, we just went from hair cell to the cells that go into the auditory system, right? So, always trying to compare different sensory systems. But in vision, why is it that you need this extra layer of not only one cell type, but actually three different cell types sitting within the stuff in the middle? Why can't you just go from rods and cones directly to the ganglion cells? You're getting all the information. You're getting every single point of light, right? So the reason for that is a very kind of a tricky thing, and it's called contrast enhancement, okay? So this is very interesting, and maybe some of you haven't seen this before, but what happens is that these rods and cones, the places that it's maximally detecting the light, it's actually laterally inhibited. So this is what I mean by lateral inhibition. Okay, so imagine that you have the following situation. You have one cone, and then you have the cone next to it, okay? So sitting in the retina. Okay, now the cone is maximally detecting light from this very specific center part of the retina, okay? So that means whatever photons are going to come in specifically at that spot, it's going to activate this part of the retina and activate this cone. Now, photons are slightly off-center on either side, on actually all four sides, right? In the world, is also going to activate the nearby cone, right? Because this cone is going to activate something that's slightly off in the world, okay? But if what you want is to pick up specifically a point of light that's right there, you actually don't want the surrounds giving you as much contribution. Because the surround is going to activate the cone that's next door. That cone is now going to be actually hyperpolarized. It's going to be negative in voltage. But that's going to send you a signal further down that says, oh, I have light here too. But so what that means is that if you want to detect light that's right in that center, you actually want to inhibit information that's coming next door. So that's actually, if you notice what I just said, that's actually contrast, right? So if any of you have messed around with Photoshop and stuff, right, there's this little slider that says contrast, right? When you increase the contrast, things go from this mellow portrait kind of thing into this edgy thing. But all that is basically it's saying for each point, neglect the information that's right next to it and enhance me. I'm the best for each pixel in that cell, in that photo. And that's exactly what's happening here, because in that center spot, you actually want to laterally inhibit stuff that's nearby. You want to say that this is where the information is coming from, so that if you have a line or you have a point specifically at that spot, you're enhancing that information that's coming in just from that spot, right? So how does it do this? You have these cells, horizontal cells, that usually is going to be inhibiting. It's going to be, okay, the detail is not so important, but basically in this picture, what is going on is that this cell is going to talk to a bipolar cell, but it's also going to be innervated by these horizontal cells. The horizontal cells are actually negatively influencing the cells nearby, so that when one cell is actually, the voltage goes down, actually it's actually causing the other guy to go voltage go up. Yeah, whichever way you want to do it. Basically, it's negative in polarity, which means that whatever is going on in this cell, you actually want the horizontal cells to actually reduce that on the other side, right? So all this information comes in. Now, these cells are actually going to be contributing less to this particular bipolar cells because of the way this horizontal cell is arranged. Again, the detail is not so important, but what that means is that ultimately, that ganglion cells that specifically toned to this center is now going to be activated by the center and then inhibited by the surround. Okay? Now that will give you a better contrast in your image. And then remember that the ganglion cells that's right next door is doing the same thing. It's now going to be enhanced by this cell, but it's going to be reduced by this cell. Right? So what that means is that for every pixel, you have an enhancement of your contrast. Okay? So I know I didn't kind of do it justice to explain exactly what this means, but it's very interesting that the visual system actually works by doing this. It's actually enhancing contrast by inhibiting nearby photoreceptors. Okay? The information that's coming in from nearby photoreceptors. Okay, so ultimately, we can talk about this more in the nervous system class, but ultimately that ganglion cells comes in and actually goes to the opposite side of the brain. So stuff on the right, on the right visual field, everything from the right visual field here is actually going to the left side of your visual cortex. And similarly, everything from the left side is actually going to the right visual cortex. Okay. It turns out there are some people have colorblindness, right? And so that's in a defect of particular cones in your retina. Okay. So can everybody see all these? If not, you might have colorblindness. It turns out it's also because the genes for particular cones are actually on the X chromosome. It turns out the males are actually a little bit more, susceptible, because we only have one X chromosome. We have X and Y, right? So women have two X's, so even when one is defective, if you have another copy on the other X, you're okay. All right. So anyway, so colorblind is specifically in cones, right? Not rods, for example. Okay. Again, I already said this, but remember that daytime vision, you want high acuity cells that are the cones. And the cones, the distribution looks like this. It's mostly concentrated on the fovea. This is what the retina looks like. And the rods are these kind of yellow shapes. And the cones are actually these red and blue and green guys. And you notice that they're mostly in the center. And then the rods are actually off-center, but they actually peak slightly off-center, not all the way on the other side. Okay. All right, so I'm going to have to skip this because we don't have time. But again, the lens is actually changing so that you're focused on far versus close things. It turns out the visual cortex is very organized as well. I don't have time to go over right now, but basically different parts of the visual cortex is tuned to different orientations in the world. Okay, so I know this is like surprise too. People go like, whoa, this is very intricate organization. But different, slightly different parts of your brain, right? Different, in fact, they're organized into columns. They're actually tuned to specific motions and also specific orientations. It's a very fine-tuned system once you get into the brain as well. And so those cells, though, are going to be getting information from multiple ganglion cells. It can't just get a single spot of light. It has to get a good region of light in order to interpret that. Okay. So anyway, so let me give you the review on vision, and then I only have very brief things to say on the motor system, so hopefully we can get to that. before we finish. Anybody want to venture about the first part? So in vertebrate eyes, the conversion of light energy to chemical energy occurs where? What did I say was the chemical that allows you to detect that? There's the cyst and the trans form of that chemical, and when the light strikes, it goes to the trans, I believe. Yes, good job, retina. Okay, rod, okay, so, and then the next one, okay? The rod, good job. Rod receptors, what did they do? What happens when light strikes? And also, you can kind of eliminate. So remember, this is about the certain chemical, right? Okay, good. So here's what's going on. So first, if this question, right? So if you don't know the answer, first of all, you eliminate potassium because we didn't never talk about potassium. Okay, so you can first eliminate B and E. Then you look at A, C, and B, and you go like, well, what happens when light strikes? Well, I know that what Ray said was that when light strikes, eventually the photoreceptor goes more negative, right? So therefore, it cannot be depolarized. Hyperpolarized actually means going more negative. So therefore, it's either C or D. Okay, then you think about how do I hyperpolarize, right? Hyperpolarized means negative voltage. If you want negative voltage, you don't want positive charges coming in, right? So you don't want the sodium channels to come in. That means you really just want to close it. So just like Ingrid said, that's D, because you have the hyperpolarized, which means it goes more negative when you close the sodium channels. Okay, good job. Okay, I don't have time to talk about taste and smell today, but it won't be on the test. So, you know, if you're interested, you can look at the slides. And I mean, the big thing with that is basically it's chemical senses, so you're actually detecting things in the air in terms of the odor, and also the taste. You have different parts of your tongue that's kind of tuned for different chemicals. Okay. So I don't have time to talk about that, but we'll talk about a little bit about effectors, which are motor systems, and these are the things that actually allows you to control the outside world, right? Anybody can do this, by the way? Anybody? No, you guys can all do this. Sit on top of another, you know, just go like, okay. Anyway, so, okay. So, first of all, what's going on? Okay, first of all, in terms of the muscular system, once you have the sensory information, stuff happens within the brain, and the brain is also going to send out a signal to say, do this, right? So, when it does this, everything is based on muscles. The muscles in your eyes and stuff like that too, right? Everything is controlled by muscles in some sense. And so let's talk about muscles, right? So ultimately, the nervous system is going to control this. But first, we talk about the muscle. There's a bunch of fibers within the muscle. You don't have to know all the details. But basically, you have these things called myosin and actin. That's kind of the key components of the muscle. Right, so they're actually going to sit in a particular arrangement with each other. I will talk about a little bit about how they work in a little bit. But basically, on how they are arranged with each other is how that muscle is going to actually contract or relax. Okay. Now, usually you have so. I don't want you guys to memorize like M and Z and stuff like that. So if you just know myosin and actin, it's okay. So, but basically, myosin is the stuff in the center, and then this stuff on the side is the actin. Okay. So the thicker guys here are the myosin. Stuff on the side are the actin. So basically, they are always going to be kind of attached to each other by these proteins. Okay. And the way that you contract and relax is basically how the myosin and the actin walk with respect to each other, okay? And it's kind of walk with respect to each other using these muscle proteins that are sitting in between them, okay? And when you contract, when you're going to have these actin kind of going through, and the myosin is going to go boom, 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 like this, walk along the actin.
And when you relax, then that muscle protein is going to go back here. Okay. So how the myosin and actin, how they are configured with respect to each other, is allowing you to either contract or relax the muscle. Okay. Now, when you actually contract and so that's kind of the muscle protein that's sitting in between, but I don't have time to go over that. I don't really have time to go over how particular they work. So remember, the thin guys are the actin, the thick guys are the myosin. What all you want is how they are walking with respect to each other. In other words, how close are they, like this or like this, with respect to each other. So what you really want is basically these proteins in the myosin, right? So the myosin actually is attached to ATP, and when you release the ATP, it's allowing the myosin head to kind of flex forward and walk through. So basically when you hydrolyze the ATP and then you rehydrolyze it, it's allowing that myosin to walk one step forward. Okay. So all you have to know from this slide is just that the ATP is necessary for you to walk along, for the myosin to walk along. That's why you actually need to expend energy to actually contract the muscle. That ATP allows the myosin to actually walk with respect to the actin. Okay, so anyway, so you need ATP, that's all. Okay, now, so I don't have time to go over exactly how this works. Basically, calcium is involved. I don't have time to tell you how or why, but calcium is the thing that is actually going to allow this process to occur, okay? So it turns out the calcium binding sites there are actually calcium binding sites within this complex, and then when you have calcium enter, you have this ability to release that myosin head, and along with ATP, it's going to allow you to walk. But I don't have time to go over it specifically. What we should know are, here's the two things that I want you to take away, okay, because we only have maybe like 8 minutes. Here's the two things that we need to talk about. So this is, again, these are just chemical details you don't have time to talk about. The one thing that you should all know is that one neuron from the brain is actually going to control more than one muscle fiber, okay? And the motor unit, when we say motor unit, that just means the motor neuron that's coming from the brain, so the thing that's going to control muscles, and all the fibers that it synapses on, okay? All the fibers that it's actually talking to, okay? That's called the motor unit. It's the one neuron and all the fibers that it's going to basically control. Okay, so what that means is that you have a motor neuron here. This is in the spinal cord, so this is coming from the brain down to the spinal cord. This particular cell, this neuron, is going to control more than one fiber. The second thing that you should know is that actually these fibers are not controlled one at a time in muscle groups as well. These fibers always kind of have control of antagonistic pairs. So here's an example. So for example, if you want to go like this, right, when you're flexing your biceps, well, what's happening is that, first of all, these biceps, these guys here, they're going to have to contract, right, because they get smaller. So myosin walking along the actin, boom, contract, right, boom. But what you notice is that the back here, this muscle back here, the triceps, is actually going to relax. So again, the myosin, right, walking opposite, right, it's relaxing in regards to the actin. So what that means is the bicep is being contracted and the tricep is being relaxed. When you go like this, now the bicep is going to relax, and the tricep is going to get shorter, right? So that's going to contract. So for every movement like this, actually, you can imagine, there's some other antagonistic pair of muscles, right? And these antagonistic pairs of muscles, the different fibers in those muscles are actually going to be controlled by different motor neurons,
But a single motor neuron is now going to control more than one fiber of this whole complex. Okay, so it's not just a single muscle that's doing anything, really, most of the time. Most of the time, it's a pair of muscles, and more likely, it's more than one pair of muscles. It's because most of your movements are more dynamic. You know, you're not just always doing this and this, this all the time. Most of the time, you're doing something in the world, like you're dancing or swimming or yoga, whatever you want to do. Many different pairs of muscles are contracting and relaxing at the same time. What that means is that you need a bunch of motor units, now that you know what motor units are, you need a bunch of motor units activated and deactivated at the same time. So I started out by saying, well, this is, you know, effector systems or motor systems seems like it's a lot easier, but actually it's also very complicated. The brain has to be able to tell specific muscle groups specific orientations and changes that is maximally going to allow you to do something. So for example, when you're playing the piano and you're using your hands like this, imagine the number of muscles that you need to be finely controlled, right? Very complicated. And not only that, this is just to do random shit on the piano, right? Just to do random shit on the piano. But when you actually need to do very specific things on the piano, that is a very specific type of control, using very specific cell types in the human brain that does very specific things. And it's very complicated. Just as complicated as the visual system. Okay, so I think that's all I want to talk about today. I have about 4 minutes. But in terms of the summary of the motor system, again, number one is it's very complicated. Number two is that you have opposing pairs of muscles. And then the other thing is that the motor unit is the one neuron that controls the different fibers that it's actually going to act on. In terms of how it actually works, basically, you want the myosin to walk along the actin, okay? And the way that this works is that it requires ATP and also requires calcium. And then it turns out that it's actually in a kind of a cycle in terms of how it works, because the cycle is that the myosin head needs to detach and then reattach, right? The myosin needs to walk along the actin, so it's going to come out, move forward, move down, come out, move down, move down. And that cycle involves calcium and ATP. So that's really all you have to know. So if you compare now, at the finish of this lecture, the sensory and the motor system and also the different senses, you notice one common theme, right? The common theme is that in order to get very, very precise control, you need a cooperation from many, many different cell types and also chemical changes in very specific ways. Very specific channel. Remember, in the visual system, specific sodium channel is going to open and close. In the auditory system, to be able to tell different pitches, you need specific parts of the cochlea to be vibrating at specific times. And then in the muscle, in the motor system, specific groups of muscles, specific fibers even, within that muscle, being activated by different motor units. So the common theme, very complicated, very specific, amazing how the human brain can actually figure this out and be able to control the effectors and also be able to sense information from very, very specific parts of the world. How does it do this? That's what we're going to talk about next time. Cool. Have a good one.